to produce results. And I would hope that with good antitrust leadership in the incoming administration, other kinds of competitive problems will be addressed with a certain kind of vigor.
Right. Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your articles in the Center for American Progress on this issue from our website. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you. Delightful to talk to you.
My guest has been Mark Jarsulik, Chief Economist at the Center for American Progress. He's worked on economic policy matters as a Deputy Staff Director and Chief Economist at the Joint Economic Committee, and also Chief Economist at the Senate Banking Committee. He's practiced antitrust and securities law at the Federal Trade Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and in private practice. We've been discussing several new antitrust lawsuits against big tech companies like Facebook and Google. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO on Thursday, December 31st at 8 p.m. for KBOO's New Year's Eve extravaganza. Join KBOO DJs as they bid 2020 goodbye and kick off the new year with positive vibes. You'll hear sets from Diablo, Top Dolla, Kabloom, and more. Again, that's KBOO's New Year's Eve extravaganza from Thursday, December 31st at 8 p.m. to Friday, January 1st at 5:30 a.m. Bring in the new year here with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, an in-depth look at how women, migrants in Central America, mothers in search of their children lost along the migrant trail, have organized themselves and now have joined with mothers from the continent of Africa and other countries to form a global movement of Mothers of the Disappeared. We look into the history of the Mothers of the Disappeared in Argentina and their global impact, and Zapatista Women, their first international women-only gathering, the first international gathering of politics, art, sport for women in struggle. We discuss Zapatista Women and the new feminism, and the migrant caravans that have made their way from Honduras and other Central American countries to the United States. Also, the new NAFTA and their wider implications, and the impact of Donald Trump's bashing of Mexicans on binationals living in Mexico. Our guest is activist and journalist based in Mexico City, Laura Carlson. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these news headlines. Vice President Mike Pence and Surgeon General Jerome Adams both received the coronavirus vaccine during a White House event aimed at convincing skeptical Americans that the vaccines are safe.
With cases rising across the country, with hospitalizations rising across the country, we have a ways to go. Vigilance and the vaccine is our way through. And building confidence in the vaccine is what brings us here this morning.
Pence called the speed with which the vaccine was developed a medical miracle. The pandemic has killed more than 310,000 in the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris also are going to be vaccinated in public, but it's unclear when President Trump will be administered the shot. Negotiators on Capitol Hill are ironing out the final details for a $900 billion COVID relief package. Congressional leaders say a weekend session is almost certain, as meeting a Friday midnight deadline appears unlikely. Congress is also up against the deadline to fund the government into the new year. Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin told CNN that Congress can't break for the holidays and leave millions of Americans struggling to get by.
It's got to be done. The day after Christmas, 12 million Americans will lose their unemployment benefits if we do nothing. And every day thereafter, another tragedy will hit another family or sector of our economy. That's unacceptable.
Both sides say they're hopeful a deal could be reached soon. The agreement includes more than $300 billion in aid to businesses, a $300 per week bonus federal jobless benefit, and renewal of soon-to-expire state benefits. However, more aid to states and local governments and liability protections from businesses will not be included as part of the compromise. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to authorize biotech firm Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use as early as today. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says shipments of Moderna's coronavirus vaccine would begin this weekend if that happens. Azar says the Moderna vaccine is shockingly effective, and he expected to get vaccinated next week if the White House physician cleared him to do so. Azar's wife has tested positive for COVID-19, and he's quarantining at the moment. The approval would come a week after the FDA cleared the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for emergency distribution. Both vaccines have been found to be more than 90% effective at preventing spread of the coronavirus. President-elect Joe Biden says he's chosen North Carolina regulator Michael Regan as his nominee to lead the Environmental Protection Agency and New Mexico Representative Deb Haaland as Interior Secretary. Biden said Thursday that the selections round out what he said would be an experienced climate team ready from their first day in office to tackle the undeniable, accelerating, punishing reality of climate change. The picks also help Biden fulfill his promise to put together a cabinet that reflects the diversity of America. Regan is black, while Haaland would be the first Native American cabinet member in American history. More than 300 Nigerian schoolboys have been freed after being kidnapped last week in an attack on their school by Islamist militants. The boys have arrived in the capital of Katsina State to celebrations of their release. Feature Story News' File Haza reports.
Governor Aminu Bello Masari says the boys who were held in the forest in neighboring Zamfara State have been freed and are currently undergoing security checks. He added that the boys would also be medically examined and reunited with their families on Friday. The kidnapping has raised growing concerns and anger about insecurity in Nigeria and violence in the country's north. President Muhammadu Buhari welcomed the students' release and asked for patience while his administration dealt with insecurity issues.
And that's File Haza reporting. A Centers for Disease Control committee is meeting to discuss which categories of workers will be deemed essential when prioritizing who will get the next COVID-19 vaccines first. And as KPFA's Chris Lee reports, the California Vaccine Advisory Committee is sorting through who would be considered essential workers when it comes to giving out those shots.
More than 8 million essential workers are slated to be vaccinated starting early next year in what's called Phase 1B of the state's vaccination plan. According to the working group, three sectors are guaranteed to receive the vaccine: food and agriculture, such as grocery clerks and farm workers, education and child care, like teachers and daycare workers, and emergency services, such as non-medical first responders, law enforcement officers, firefighters, shelter workers, and child youth services providers. Over 140 emails were received by the committee from groups seeking to prioritize their workers in vaccine distribution. The Drafting Guidelines Work Group meets December 20th to continue defining which essential workers will be in line first for the COVID-19 vaccine. I'm Chris Lee, reporting for KPFA.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And those were our news headlines. And I would now like to welcome our guests. Stay with us for the hour. We're doing an in-depth discussion focusing on south of the border. We'll be talking about mothers whose children have been lost along the migrant trail, how they've organized themselves, and how they've now joined with mothers from other countries to form a global movement of mothers of the disappeared. We talk about the Zapatista women and, of course, the migrant caravans, the new NAFTA agreement between Mexico and the United States, Trump's bashing of people of Mexican descent, and more. So you're going to want to stay with us, an in-depth discussion with Laura Carlson. Laura, welcome.
Thanks so much, Margaret.
Laura Carlson is the director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. Based in Mexico City, she is a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Fortune, America's Updater, Foreign Policy in Focus, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. And she is also an activist on both sides of the border. Is that okay, Laura, to say that about
yes,
you?
Yes, I that was an apt description.
Okay. Laura, what we're going to do is to start off this discussion on the migrant caravans. There have been a series of migrant caravans, and we're going to go to a clip from DW English.
Every Friday, armed gangs forced these young barbers to cut their hair. On one occasion, they were caught up in a shootout with police. The barbers closed their salon to escape, but lived in constant fear for their lives. That's why they decided to abandon their homes and set off for the United States.
I had to go to the gang members to cut their hair. But I couldn't keep doing it, out of fear. I spoke about it with my cousin, and we decided to flee. We're afraid and just want to work in peace.
As well as violence, economic problems are pushing people to migrate. Almost three-quarters of all Hondurans live in poverty, according to some estimates. And more than half of the self-employed there live in extreme poverty.
We are searching for a better homeland and opportunities to work. We want to move our families forward. People cannot bear this situation any longer. The crisis has been getting worse for years.
It's happening because of the political situation. That's why people are fleeing now. They have nothing to eat.
I'm supporting these migrants. They're fleeing because there's no work here. How can Donald Trump treat them as murderers?
Poverty in Honduras is on the rise, even though the government has invested more in social programs. This woman has tried seven times to reach the United States. Only once did she make it across the border, only to be deported. But her situation is so desperate that she plans to try again.
I just can't go on like this. Even if I could find a job, I wouldn't earn enough to support us. The pay is just too low. I have three children who need to be fed.
On her last journey, she was fleeing an abusive husband. She took her three children on the arduous trip. They suffered hunger and illness. Eventually, they were arrested by Mexican authorities and deported.
This is a bite wound. I reported it to the police and sought protection in Mexico as I fled with my three children. He notified the migration authorities and we spent 8 months in detention.
Women suffer other types of violence. They are victims of domestic and sexual abuse and are threatened by gangs who try to recruit their children. That's why 20% more women than men are fleeing Honduras, according to a migration expert.
They are pressured into prostitution or are forced to live with people who are involved in organized crime. It's a symptom of the vulnerability of women.
Migrants or refugees, it's hard to draw a line in a country where desperation and danger go together. For them, escape seems the only option.
Laura Carlson, let's break that down a little bit, that clip from DW, because there are references to the political situation. We need to discuss that a little bit because, you know, often when you hear people living in the United States hear something like that, the idea is, oh, there are these poor people. They really don't know how to organize themselves, you know, so that, you know, they can have a better government and a better life. And instead, they're coming to the United States. Why can't they deal with their own problems right on their home turf? So, Laura Carlson, I think we need some context here for what has happened in Honduras, including the role of the United States that has led to really a humanitarian crisis. Laura Carlson.
That's what it is. And it's been going on for a while. As people know, this exodus from Central America that began in mid-October is primarily Hondurans. Later, there have been a large number of Salvadorans, and there are some people from other countries as well, but it's primarily from Honduras. They left from San Pedro Sula, which for many years, and this is the first factor that we have to take into account, was the most violent city in the world. That has to do with the same reasons that Mexico has become so violent, the imposition of this war on drugs and militarization policy that's coming straight from the United States and that has led to the country being flooded with arms to a corrupt and illegitimate government that end up in the hands of criminals. Ever since the coup in 2009, Honduras, you always have to go back to 2009, and the military coup against the elected government, there's been a situation of complete chaos and a breakdown of all democratic institutions that's sidelined the society, that's destroyed democracy and the rule of law within the country, and that's a situation in which violent crime also thrives oftentimes, again, as we see here in Mexico, complicit with and in collusion with the corrupt state as well. So we have the coup in 2009. The United States supports the coup, and they maneuver to make it impossible for the elected government to come back. So there's a coup-sponsored election that on the face of it and in every sense was completely illegitimate. You can't have an illegitimate government organize an election to legitimate itself. You know, that's just beyond all international law. And members that were close or individuals that were close to that illegal and very violent coup government or regime are elected to the presidency in Honduras. Then the most recent political crisis was the elections last November, in which the president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who's very unpopular, still being protested against because of the way in which he took office, decides to re-elect himself, which is completely against the Honduran constitution. Again, through a series of maneuvers and control of the courts, and I think we should take just a second to point out the role that the courts are playing in destroying democratic institutions lately in so many countries. He allows himself to get on the ballot, and he loses the elections, rather surprisingly, because there was a part of the left that said, this is just illegal, we're not even going to vote. But enough people came out and said, we are going to vote, and we're going to vote against him, that he actually loses the elections and then steals the elections. And when he is recognized as the winner of the elections, members of the U.S. Embassy are literally standing beside him. So, and there's a series of protests that are ongoing, actually, in Honduras. There's a full-blown political crisis. There are scores of assassinations by the government, the illegitimate government of Juan Orlando, against dissidents. And the opposition has very clearly identified, and it's been documented, the role of the United States government in fomenting all this. As a result, it adds to the poverty, it adds to the general violence, it adds to the criminal violence in Honduras, and we begin to see the exodus of approximately 300 Hondurans a day. So what happened in mid-October that from a steady flow of 300 Hondurans a day, most of whom would qualify under international law as refugees, there's also a tremendous amount of violence against women and against LGBT community, because in this situation of lawlessness, and of kind of a hyper-patriarchal militarist society, those kinds of violences also flourish.
Yeah, Laura, before we go into which is a really important point you're about to discuss, and this, of course, is the October 2018 migrant caravan. Of course, there were other caravans prior to that. But just on the situation in Honduras itself, a lot of people living in the United States are not necessarily aware that Honduras, in addition to a indigenous population, there's also a large population of people of African descent, the Garifuna, and that those, the indigenous communities and the Garifuna communities, along with the LGBTQ communities, were particularly targeted following the coup. Could you just say a little about that?
Yes, this is a very important point, Margaret, and I'm really glad you brought it up. Because what happens after the coup is that they literally adopted a campaign called Honduras Open for Business in English. And Honduras Open for Business was essentially that. They welcomed transnational investment with very little controls or regulation. And the mega projects that came into the country at that time, plus the use of cheap labor for production, displaced a lot of people, and particularly indigenous and Afro-Honduran communities. These were mega projects, like, for example, in the Garifuna communities, they had huge tourism projects come in on the Atlantic coast where they were living. You know, there were communities there, and they literally displaced them oftentimes at the hands of the military. Mm. There'd been a steady flow of immigration. People who are listening and live in the New York area, for example, of Garifuna people to the United States. But this represented a new phase, and a much more violent and a much more intense phase of displacement. When we talk about migration, we're really not talking about migration. We're talking about forced displacement of population.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's why it's so large. So the mega projects and this new extractivism is a word that we'll be hearing more and more, although it sounds strange. It represents the kinds of industries that go in to take natural resources out of a country, oftentimes displacing local populations, again, especially Afro-descendant and indigenous populations that have been the stewards of these resources for generations. And they take control, they displace the populations, and an all-out exploitation of the natural resources begins, with most of the gains, of course, for that ending up in the pockets of the transnational corporations and the countries in which they're based, and no gain and a tremendous amount of bloodshed and economic loss and poverty on the part of the communities who traditionally lived there.
Right. So this is really about displacement. A lot of people then end up, you know, in the caravans. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are doing a special on south of the border, in particular discussing the migrant caravans, the way women have been organizing themselves. And our guest is Mexico City-based journalist Laura Carlson. So, Laura, now fast forward again to October of 2018 caravan, and just the conditions on the caravan. The clip made some reference to it, the conditions in particular for women. And, just carry on with your point on that.
I've carried out a number of extensive interviews with members of the caravan. And the biggest phrase is just Central America couldn't take it anymore. There are a lot of conspiracy theories about who started the caravan and why and what were the political motivations. Many of them related to the U.S. midterms because it became such a big issue in the midterms when Donald Trump began using it as a scare tactic to mobilize a very racist and xenophobic and anti-immigrant base. But even though it was clearly used for that purpose when it started, you know, the roots, as we've discussed, were much deeper. And you can't talk about these people as a manipulated group of people. We're talking about up to 10,000 people in this. Women within the caravan have been very important, both because they make up such a large part of it and because of leadership roles at many points along the way. It's the first time that we've seen these kinds of numbers, you know, 7,000 people leaving Honduras at the same time and continuing to travel in a group that large. And it's also the first time that we've seen the women and children make up such a large part of it. The explanation for that is simple. Women face the greatest risks along the migrant trail. They're the most vulnerable. The statistics, the tragic statistics, are that some 60% of women migrating from Central America up through Mexico to the northern border are raped along the way. They also face all the risks that other migrants face, which are extortion, robbery, physical beatings, detention as well. It's just become in Mexico an extremely, extremely dangerous trip. So when they form a big group, women instantly know that they can be safer. They no longer have to pay the $15,000 that they would have to pay to organize crime or take the risks, because many times the sexual abuse or ending up in sexual slavery or human trafficking is actually happens at the hands of the people that they hire to take them to the border. So they find that moving in these groups is actually a safety mechanism, and that was the reason that so many women and children suddenly joined the exodus that we saw in mid-October. Yeah. It's something that they had been wanting to do maybe for a long time. They needed to get out of where they are, and they found this to be a safe way to do it.
And then you have these mothers accused by some north of the border, you know, including some in this administration, of child abuse because they are traveling with their children and in some cases even babies on this migrant trail, as you call it. Laura Carlson.
The characterizations of especially mothers, but of the refugees in general in the United States, have been vile and absolutely false. These women are trying to save their children. They're leaving situations where the last woman I spoke with is from La Ceiba, an Afro-descendant Honduran woman, and she had to get out to create safer conditions for her family. This is what you hear from almost all the women who are taking part in the exodus right now. So to say that they are guilty of child abuse and to portray this as some kind of a flippant decision to follow the American dream, to want to have the lifestyle that the United States has created, is completely false. They're escaping the lifestyle that the United States created for them. One of the people I asked, I said, well, what do you feel about the fact that in the United States they're saying that you are invaders? And they said, the United States has an army base in the middle of our country. Who's the invader?
Yeah, and as you know, Donald Trump has sent over 5,000 active duty troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, and he actually made a comment that if the migrants throw a rock at you, to respond with live rounds. And sadly, that was taken up and used, I think, I can't remember if it was in Senegal, by troops there to shoot at migrants. If it's not Senegal, excuse me, but it was
a country in West Africa. And I read that report. So his words definitely have meaning, not only for what they mean on the U.S.-Mexico border, but as you know, people around the world hear what Donald Trump is saying. I mean, after all, the most powerful leader on the globe at this particular point. I wouldn't exactly refer to him as a leader in any case. Laura?
Well, the Border Patrol has shot youth that they claim, and in many cases it wasn't even true, you know, for throwing stones. And it's part of this complete dehumanization plan where refugees are a foreign enemy, and they're often, there's a vocabulary used to portray them. Well, they use the word infestation, you know, where they're really denied even their humanity in this anti-immigrant xenophobic campaign that's taking place. I was recently looking at the report, the risk assessment by the Northern Command of the Pentagon, specifically on the migrant caravan, and another one of the results, and one of the things they mentioned there openly, is that with Donald Trump sending troops to the border, militias have been formed again and are going out armed
to the border,
to supposedly defend the border. So there's a huge risk of assassinations by both the U.S. government and right-wing militias in the United States for people trying to cross the border and bring their families to safety.
Absolutely. And Laura Carlson, we're going to have to pause for a short station break, but this really, what we're discussing right now about the migrant trail and the violence goes into the next discussion we will have about the new global mothers of the disappeared, because we know that thousands of people have died coming from south of the border trying to come into the United States. Sometimes bodies are found, sometimes they're not. People are kidnapped, as you say. And also, when we look at what is happening of people fleeing, for example, the continent of Africa, some parts of Africa, to try to make their way into Italy and other European countries, and the treatment that they get, and the thousands of people who drown and who are lost on that particular migrant trail. So we'll be talking about all this when we return, including new feminism and Zapatista women, NAFTA, and more. Don't go away. We'll be right back to continue our discussion with Laura Carlson.
Para decidir si sigo poniendo esta sangre en tierra, este corazón que bate su parche sol y tinieblas, para continuar caminando al sol para estos desiertos, para recalcar que estoy viva en medio de tantos muertos, para decidir, para continuar, para recalcar y considerar, solo me hace falta que estés aquí con tus ojos claros.
And that song, Zapatista Women. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth, and you can also subscribe for a free podcast. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. where we also have an in-depth community calendar and lots of stories that we just have no time, run out of time to cover on the news or on the air, or stories related to what we have covered on the air. On Instagram, we are at So True Radio. And today we want to give a shout out to all of our listeners along the U.S.-Mexico border, on both sides of that U.S.-Mexico border. That's our shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. And we are having an in-depth conversation with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program for the Center for International policy. She's based in Mexico City, a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Fortune, America's Update of Foreign Policy and Focus, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. She's also an activist on a number of these issues. So, Laura Carlson, before we took our station break, we were talking about the dangers that migrants face coming up from south of the border and the thousands of lives that are lost. And I can't even imagine the heartbreak back home for the mothers and the children and the family members who are left as their loved ones go off to try to seek a better way of life, to escape from the exploitation of their home country at the hands of the U.S. And other Western powers. And even without losing a loved one along the migrant trail, the immigration process, you know, I'm an immigrant myself, and I'm still heartbroken having to leave my beautiful island and my village and the people I left behind, who wept as our family left. So I don't think people understand and really can grasp the emotional, physical, and other tolls that it really takes to leave all of what you've known behind, and for good reason, right? Laura Carlson, tell us about this, because there has been a movement of mothers, and I'd like you to talk about that, for over a decade now, who have been going along the migrant trail in search of their missing loved ones. And let's talk about that first, and then talk about this a new thing that is happening with globalizing this movement. Laura Carlson.
The caravan of Central American mothers goes up through Mexico, where they last heard from their missing children. The last communication maybe came from the northern border or the southern border, and then after that, years, in some cases even more than a decade passed, without having any idea of what happened to their sons or their daughters. And they've been able to put the, you know, to actually organize a meeting between the mother and the child, no longer children, of course. And these are very emotional moments. So this movement has been happening, and it's also forged, in addition to just looking for the children, their loved ones, it's also forged an identity for many of these women as activists, as human rights defenders. They've had to learn the law, they've had to learn the migrant routes, they've had to learn the geopolitical context of what happened to their children along the way, and they've become a group that's very united. They console each other, they provide each other with meaning in the midst of what can be a very devastating and individualized grief. So this process has been revolutionary in their lives, and in many cases within Mexican politics as well. Another process that's been going on for a long time here is the mothers, the Mexican mothers of disappeared, who have organized and who have created local and even national organizations to demand the search for their children, not only living, which is the focus of the Central American caravan, but also to search for remains, which is unfortunately the reality oftentimes here. And they have found thousands and thousands of human remains going out by themselves and opening, you know, digging into the earth where they've had tips that there are clandestine graves. And the same is true for the mothers who have lost their children in the Mediterranean, which they now describe as a sea that's become a cemetery. So they got these women together, with something that had never been done before, here in Mexico City, okay, the 2nd through the 4th of November of 2018. So they got women together from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, Spain and Italy, where they have the networks of support and where migrants, it's a frequent destination. Tunis, Senegal, Morocco, I'm translating here, Mauritania, and the United States. It was an amazing meeting because what they found is they had these very different cultures and contexts in some ways, including political contexts, but there was a tremendous amount of similarities, which includes the kind of forced displacement we were talking about in the first part of the show. It includes the dangers that migrants face, and it includes these anti-immigrant policies that are coming from the wealthy developed countries in the north.
Right. And I mean, this, Laura, it just gets me thinking about so many different things. I mean, the idea then you have at least one West African country, a number of North African countries, which makes a lot of sense in terms of people getting there and then trying to get on these boats. And it is indeed a sea of death. And again, what is happening on the continent of Africa, so much related to the political and economic situation there, where Africa has been so raped of its resources and wealth, and you know, the most impoverished continent in the world, while the richest continent in the world in terms of natural resources under it, but also how the impact of the U.S. Destabilizing a country like Libya, literally killing Muammar Gaddafi, and the arms then that flowed from there into places like Mali to destabilize Mali, Morocco, talk about weapons, you know, coming into the country and therefore a lot of violence, but also you just the dire economic situation is so heartbreaking. So it's just fantastic then to have women from those countries on the continent coming together with women from Central America, and the kind of multiracial in that way, Afro and indigenous and mixed in indigenous people who are mixed. It must have been quite an experience and quite an outpouring, Laura Carlson.
Yeah, we had to get translation teams from English to Spanish to French to Arabic,
yeah.
You know, going back and forth. And wow. Yet there was an instant understanding in many ways. You know, at first, the Central American women especially, they would have thought they had nothing in common with women from Africa, and they immediately found out that they did, and especially what they always refer to as the grief and the love that motivates their movements as mothers. So one of the most powerful statements or lessons that came out of this process was the power of women, and the power of mothers in particular as a social force, because these women began to search for their sons and daughters. But what happened after that is something much bigger that transcended the individual loss and the individual search. It turned into a collective movement that challenged openly the systems that led to the death and then later the indifference toward that death by the governments, by the states, and by the economic systems, and with a very strong moral image of a mother's grief, was able to reach out to society and say, something is not right here. And it's not just not right for me, a mother who has lost her child. It's not right for anybody.
Right. And were there specific demands that came out of it, or will these women, these mothers, continue to work together and perhaps expand to include mothers who have disappeared from other countries as well? Laura Carlson.
Yes, absolutely. That's the idea. And it's not just an idea. It's down on paper as part of the plan, the organizing plan for the Mother Summit here in Mexico City. There's the specific demands. There's a long list of activities that include keeping touch, creating a list of the mothers. There's going to be a new caravan from Tunisia, I think, to France. They're just beginning the process of learning from the Central American women how to carry out these caravans in Africa and Europe. They're going to continue with that. And they're calling for ending family separation. They're calling for states to live up to their international obligations in terms of respecting refugee rights, in terms of the right to life itself, and what their obligations are to search for people who are disappeared. In Mexico alone, the number of disappeared is now up to 40,000. You can imagine how many families and beyond even the immediate family have been affected by this phenomenon, really, and that holds true for many of the other countries. They're also calling to guarantee the right to mobility, the right to free transit in these countries, because if these individuals, if their sons and daughters weren't forced into this clandestine existence just because they're trying to move across one border or another, they wouldn't have to face these kinds of risks, and they wouldn't lose their lives in the act of trying to preserve their lives by getting out of conditions where they're imminently threatened.
Yeah, you know, Laura Carlson, I could think of at least, there are so many examples in terms of women who've gone missing and, you know, activist women in Haiti, et cetera. But certainly here in the U.S., but also in Canada, there have been scores, over 1,000 of indigenous women who have been victims of serial murders or who have been disappeared, their families looking for them, and there is such a devaluation or a double standard in terms of the value of human life. In Southern California, I've been dealing with this whole issue of the serial murders and disappearance of hundreds of black women in South Los Angeles. And the missing indigenous women and the black women victims of serial murders, I mean, they get such little attention. It's almost as though, well, these are throwaway people. So they don't deserve respect and attention like when one white Euro blonde student or whatever goes missing, and then it becomes national news. So I could see something like this global movement of mothers. You know what I mean? That of also looking at the situation of indigenous women, of black women in the United States as well. Do you know what I mean, Laura?
Yes, definitely. So the problem is twofold. One is, as these societies, such as the United States society clearly now, becoming more openly racist in the context of anti-immigrant movements, there's a real battle to try to make the society more sensitive to the fact that we are mothers like you, whatever color you are. Mm-hmm. We feel this pain. Our children matter. It's tragic that you'd have to say something like that even in a
That's
society,
right.
But that is the case with indigenous and Afro-descendant families in this region, and unfortunately we can anticipate that it's not something that's going to get better in the near future when we see some of the ultra-right governments that are openly racist and that are coming to power in the region, in the United States, in Brazil
yeah.
and in other countries.
Absolutely.
And then the other part of it is trying to confront the governments, because the governments, they're racist, they're discriminatory. They don't care when they're members of these populations, and they also have they also in general just don't listen to women. They'll say, "Oh, your daughter probably ran off with somebody." You know, they've been shocked at the callousness and sometimes the what we call re-victimization that they've confronted when they've tried to make a government that's supposed to be the guarantee of their human rights respond to the deepest pain a human being can feel, which is the loss of a child.
Right, and then
huge battle, but they've become much more, you know, enthusiastic, much stronger by coming together.
Absolutely, and you know, you're absolutely right about that, and also the fact that folks, you know, mothers in particular, are fighting back. You know, these days there's such a move that takes us into the other discussion about the new feminism that's growing, of which this movement is clearly a part of, because a lot of people really don't want to talk about mothers these days. You know what I mean? It's just unconscionable, given that mothers are producing everybody on the planet. But Laura Carlson, then just talking a bit about that, I'm mindful of the clock here and what is happening with Zapatista women and in Zapatista communities. I know they're calling for, and they've had over the years, some encuentros during Women's History Month in March. And just not that long ago, they also had a big international gathering, first international gathering of politics, art, sport, and culture for women in struggle. Tell us a little bit what's happening in with mm-hmm. Zapatista women.
Well, the meeting in March, which I attended with a group of women, was unprecedented. There were 5,000 women there, plus 2,000 Zapatista women from the communities nearby. It was a huge effort at logistics, as you can imagine, out yes. in the mountains of Chiapas, just bringing together latrines and food and some place to put a sleeping bag for that many women. It was an amazing feeling, and it was extremely well organized. With the Zapatista women, who do not have a lot, hosting this many women from all over the world. There were activities that just showed the way that feminism is reinventing itself under increasingly hostile conditions throughout the world. So there's no real, no way to sum up the activities there, because they were all over the map, mm-hmm. both geographically and in terms of what kinds of things women are doing. But there was a tremendous amount of energy, and some of the mothers that disappeared were able to be there, women who are working against extractivism and displacement, land defenders who have been particularly at risk, women land defenders, many times indigenous women land defenders or Afro-descendant land defenders, talking about the kinds of battles they face. And the more we get to know each other and understand the ways in which they're linked, but especially to understand in ways in which the threats are linked, that the threats emanate from this same economic system that puts money before people, that discriminates and creates violence against women. The more we understand that, the more able we are to link up and create these stronger movements. So this was a very encouraging point in the history of the development of many of these movements. They went back to their homes to do very different kinds of work, but with a greater understanding of how it all links up.
Yeah, the interrelationship of all of it. And we can't leave the discussion about women and these movements south of the border without really just mentioning the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina responding to the military dictatorship there. Those, I think initially it was, 4 or 14 mothers with white scarves that came into the capital city in Argentina to really demand, where are their children, that they've disappeared. And they've been such an inspiration, I imagine, to the this new mothers, global mothers organization seeking their loved ones, as well as the caravan as mothers who for the past decade or so have gone along the migrant trail looking for their children. Laura, just a quick touch on the relationship between those mothers in Argentina and this movement.
Absolutely, Margaret. They have been an inspiration, and they're kind of the classic example and one of the earliest examples of mothers organizing to confront dictatorships and authoritarian governments in defense of their children and taking great personal risks and sacrifices in order to do that. So there's been a constant relationship between that movement. As you know, many of the mothers are much older now and yet continue to be very active, and new younger women have come into the movement in Argentina as well with the same banner of searching for loved ones lost during the dictatorship, disappeared, not lost, but forcibly disappeared by the government during the dictatorship, as well as broadening to other issues. I remember I first met one of the mothers. She was already older and came all the way up to Honduras to a meeting against militarization. So that movement, too, has known that it has to connect to other movements against what's happening in the system, that they never lose the moral authority and the focus on finding their children, which is always going to be foremost in their minds and their hearts, but they have broadened out their scope of understanding and of political work as defenders for human rights and as activists against the systems that disappeared them in the first place. So here was this grandmother wading knee-deep in the mud in some village in Honduras to attend a regional anti-militarization meeting as part of the commitment that she assumed after the first day that she went out to try to find her missing daughter. And that's what's happened. That's the kind of transformation that happens both to the women and to their movements as they begin to organize on this level.
Right. And mothers so often at the forefront of struggles for justice. I see in the statement from Selma James and Nina Lopez, where they say mothers everywhere are the first line of defense for our children and for the whole community. So, and every Thursday, the mothers of the disappeared were out there. And I know in relation to Haiti, when we are out there protesting people who disappear, who have disappeared, and demanding them back, we often chose Thursday as that date in recognition of the inspiration of the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina. Now, finally, the time has really, really flown. And given this in-depth discussion of really such a human and beautiful movement and movements coming up south of the border, from the Zapatista women to the mothers organizing themselves in Central America and Argentina and elsewhere, it's then very, very difficult to hear this. But this is what people living in the United States are hearing, and I imagine people living in Mexico responding to. And that's what we'll deal with finally. Here's Donald Trump on Mexicans.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. They beat us at the border, people are flowing through, drugs are coming across, pouring across. We're gonna have our borders nice and strong, we're gonna build the wall. I'm gonna build a wall, and Mexico's gonna pay for it, right? Calderon, former president, Calderon said, Mexico will not pay for the wall. Could we have your comment? I said, yes. The wall just got 10 feet higher. We have a tremendous deficit. We have a trade deficit with Mexico. They'll pay for the wall. They'll be very happy about it. Believe me, I'll talk to them.
This is going
to
be a wall. This isn't one of those deals where they jump over it. They go to Home Depot, buy a ladder, jump over the wall. This is a serious, this is a Trump wall.
We're going to do the wall. And by the way, who's going to pay for the wall?
Laura Carlson, very jarring indeed. Just final thoughts from you and the impact that has had of people who are binational, for example, living in Mexico, but just generally the reaction in Mexico.
I'm an immigrant. I've been here for 30 years now. I have a deep love for my community in the United States and for my community here in Mexico, and it breaks my heart. It started during the campaign, even before he won. I just the thought that so many people in the United States could fall for this image of the Mexican people that I know and love as invaders, as criminals, as rapists, you know, these vast generalities that have nothing to do with human beings, you know. It's completely, again, a dehumanization. So it's a very, very dangerous. It's a manipulation for political purposes. It's tragic in human terms, and the worst of it is that it's going to lead, and already has led, to policies that take human lives, like the lives of all these people who have been disappeared as a result of the U.S.-sponsored war on drugs in Mexico, the lives of all the immigrants who have died in the deserts, in the oceans, and in the mountains as they tried to make their way to a safer and more decent life for them and their families.
Yeah, and it seems...
It's a huge challenge.
Yeah, and this stuff is getting globalized. I mean, Bannon is running around and, internationally really trying to whip up this kind of racist, white mm-hmm. supremacist, worldview. And we see these kind of strong, quote-unquote, strong men, coming to power in places like Brazil and in Poland and other places. So as mothers, we have our work cut out for us, don't we? Because first line of defense of children and the whole community.
Absolutely. It really is a battle of life against death, because it's a system of death that prioritizes money over human beings, as I said before, and mothers are defending life. And not just the fact that they have given birth, but that the fact that they're so tied to caregiving and to activities that depend on and that sustain communities. So there is a international movement out there that Steve Bannon's whipping up. You have to watch out, because it's not only evident in the countries where the ultra-right has taken power, but where there's growing right movements that still haven't taken power, but that are poisoning societies every day. So it's an international movement. We have to create an international movement to confront it.
Right, and to build from what is already there. Well, Laura Carlson, I'm so sorry to say we're out of time. We're going to have to continue this discussion some way, somehow, but we appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Margaret. Thank you very much.
Okay. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our board op for today. And I'd like to thank our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Is your organization planning a virtual event? Looking for a media co-sponsorship? Then contact KBOO today